Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. We're coming up at the end of September. October's rolling around. The beans are getting the corns out of the field, and Halloween is going to be on next on the agenda. Last week, I was finishing up our onstage production of Peter Pan. And so first off, I want to thank Denise Nichols, Major Nichols, for doing an incredibly good job last week, because it's kind of hard to be on the radio when you're on the stage playing a pirate. So, Denise, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. We had a delightful time reviewing the film Women at War. And thank Christy Davis and her husband, Dennis, for having done that for veterans.
A lot of people don't understand how significant it is and how different it is for women when they go to war. I mean, for all of us guys that have been there many times, you have the camaraderie and you have the closeness, and you can get around all over the place. But for a woman, as you know yourself from your personal experience, it's substantially different, isn't it?
It is. And mentioning that, I want to lead into Remembering Vets today, and I just searched out another veteran of the Gulf War that died, and her name is, it's a female, and we're seeing that, and she was only 48 years old, and died on September 13th in Montana, okay, and she was a staff sergeant during the Gulf War. And doesn't say what she died of. I'm looking at it, but not seeing what she died of or any clues there. But 48 years old. We're losing too many of them before they're 50 or even in their 50s. It's just ridiculous to pull these up every week and get listings of them. It's painful. It's very, very painful.
I think when you went to war, you had a daughter who was extraordinary, very, very young.
Yeah, she was 4 when I left.
4 years old, left, so you're sitting there missing, while you were gone to war for that time, missing some of the most incredible and personal human development traits that your daughter, you know, encountered at that 4 to 5 year old range.
Well, and one of the other things we haven't talked about, Doug, is the high rate, I think, of conception problems and delivering full-term babies, and they have never tracked that issue of fetuses that were lost, not carried to full term, and that applies to females and the male veterans. There was never any data collected on those that served in the Gulf War and then had females having trouble carrying their infant and losing their infant before they were born, and much less the male veterans. And more of the male veterans are talking about that loss of children that, you know, they were looking forward to, and it was after they came home and conceived them that they died. The only data that's been collected has been on, you know, the birth defects, cardiac and actual birth defects. And only in certain states that have a registry that meets their GOFAR approval, I guess. And a lot of those states are not where the huge majority of Gulf War veterans are living. And I feel like that's been a neglected area in our Gulf War illness, of the loss of children that were not carried to full term or that died shortly after they were born.
But we're seeing that the same thing. Not only do we see that in all the female vets with the children, but we're seeing that same thing in the, what we'll call the non-combatants, and even some of the combatants in all these nations we went to war in, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Balkans, Somalia.
And much less an online registry that we could track the early deaths of our Gulf War veterans from 1991. I pulled up another one that died September 24th. He was only 51 years old. He was a U.S. Marine Corps sergeant, Patrick Joseph Connor, age 51. And, you know, we really need the VA to be doing a better job for us and looking at these early deaths in their 40s and 50s is just too young to die. There is something drastically wrong And it's not suicides at this time that I'm hearing about. It's deaths from illnesses, from cardiac, from strokes, from different things. And I just feel like our country has truly let us down.
Well, you know, it's one thing we've talked about from day one. And when you and I first met each other, boy, it seems like an eternity ago. It was while I was still just coming off active duty for the last time and having done all the work on depleted uranium as the director of the Depleted Uranium Project and then doing all the environmental work for the U.S. Army at the Corps of Engineers Research Lab here at the U of I. But I think one thing that struck me, and we had talked about this and we were seeing this immediately because since our unit was a theater preventive medicine command in charge of all this stuff and doing all the hazmat, all the chem bio and everything, what we had seen right off the bat, and as you had pointed out, the incredible complex toxic exposures that very specifically affected the females, but as you know, has affected everybody else, has just been devastating. And on the fertility of the woman, I think you had mentioned it to me. I mean, this is going on 15 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, wow. It's longer than that, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's, you know, they never track, you know, the female problems of their menstrual cycle, even being abnormal and having to have hysterectomies early because they were bleeding and they couldn't control it, didn't even look to see what the problem was, to those that stopped their menstrual cycles early in life. These are some of the female issues that were just ignored. And, you know, the VA doctors didn't even collect the data. And it's just, you know, I want it stopped. I want the new vets to have a better go at it than we did, but I want us to also really push the issue of the first Gulf War and the illnesses that have occurred, the breakdown in our health, the breakdown in our families, because the compensation that we fought for and that happened, you know, our bill was, gosh, back in 1998, I think, if I remember right, where we got the other symptoms listed. And yet still, you know, even with presumptions, they're not taking care of the vets and getting them compensated quickly like they could. If they're documented with these problems, you know, it should be no question asked. They're compensated. Chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, the menstrual problems are listed, the headaches, the irritable bowel. And that has not been done, and we've fallen behind the Vietnam vets as they've, you know, added presumptions for them. We've fallen behind the OIF and OEF vets, and, you know, it's like we're at the bottom of the bucket still, and it's just not right. They're still fighting us on, you know, some stress-related, but the physiological damage that has been done. And they don't even look at the vision problems, the hearing problems that started after the war of ringing in the ears, constant tinnitus, the visual problems, the hearing problems, the dental problems haven't even been looked at because unless you get rated 100%, it's very hard to get your vision problems looked at, your dental problems looked at. And as you and I both know, our teeth are just breaking. They're so fragile that they break. You try to save it with root canals and putting crowns on, and the crowns deteriorate sooner than they ever should or ever documented as having happened. I mean, these are real health problems, and, you know, if you're not compensating them and getting them to 100%, they're not even being looked at for those problems.
The thing, and I think with all this stuff, and it's very important, and again tonight what I want to do is review, we've kind of led into it, a review of the toxic exposures that have incurred and what is happening and what needs to be done. And all of the medical problems that you've enumerated and also talked about with the females are just, I mean, staggering.
Jack, one of the first ways I got involved, and I, you know, remember getting online back on the old Prodigy Network where we had bulletin boards. And Victor Sylvester out of Texas and Coy Overstreet, who were Vietnam vets that had children, their adult children, serving in the Gulf War. And they were invaluable in putting us all together and networking us in the early, early beginnings after we came home and got online on the computer. And that was like in 92 and 93 and 94. And that's where our effort started. And there was a handful of us that stood up and started, you know, pounding the floors. The first hearings we had were in November of 93. And I know when I first, you know, talked to Victor Sylvester and he found out I was a nurse and I was concerned and trying to put the pieces together of what was happening to us, I would get phone calls that he, you know, as he found people, if they called him or emailed him, that they would call me. And I might have been one of the first people to talk to him. And they just felt like, well, what's happening? We just seem to be getting old faster. And I would do kind of a nursing history from head to toe of, you know, what is your current problem, just going through it by system, and how does that compare to how you were before the war? No one had any complaints, no problems before the war. This surfaced as a period of time increases after the war, and we've had peaks and valleys of the reporting and people waking up. And as we know, young people are going to deny they have any problem, even if they do. They don't want to acknowledge it. Their thing is to get back to life, get back to their jobs, their education, and, you know, move forward.
I think one of the most important things along with that, and I can't reiterate it enough, we all came back, and I mean, when I came back from Vietnam in 1971 for, you know, the second time, I mean, it was basically you get on an airplane, you fly home, you land, you get off the airplane, and you're home, and that's it, and you get on with your life. And the same thing happened when we went to Desert Storm, and the exact same thing I know is happening right now continuously. If the individual makes any, you know, makes any complaint, then he's stuck in limbo.
Yeah.
He's not going to be able to get out, and we know from congressional hearings that the medical care that they need if they get put into these transition units is not happening. They're not getting proper care whatsoever. There's been congressional hearing, after finding on that with no changes. And so what you do is you come back, and what I see today is these guys are getting out of the Guard and the Reserve, or they're off active duty, and they're coming home, and they want to go back to college, or they want to get a job and get back to their families. And so they ignore the medical problems until they get so severe that they jump out at us. I think.
And what should have been done from the get-go is what we tried to do for the OIF-OEF was that your physicals need to be complete, hands-on, medical testing, urine, blood saved, x-rays, the whole works before you send somebody to war. And then when you come back, you should have a complete and thorough physical with blood and urine and, you know, everything documented. And starting from that point so that we can go back and scientifically look for things. That was not done for us. It wasn't done for Vietnam. And so we wanted to make a difference, and we fought them to do that with OIF-OEF, and they came out with survey forms instead of actually hands-on and really looking and getting the data from the human body to find the differences and
I think
to find
that's
out
so,
what was happening.
I mean, that's so critical because when we look at all of the stuff that happened and what you're referring to, and again, we'll make sure this is online for everybody that needs it if they don't have it, or they can contact us and get it, is the Post-Deployment Physical Assessment Form, Department of Defense Form 2796. And I know for OIF-OEF, you were instrumental in forcing our buddy Mikey Kilpatrick and the guys to get this put together.
Well, I was one, but we had Steve Robertson, who had finished up with the Osagui Group, active duty, that came in with the Gulf War veterans for executive director. And I have to say this about Steve. He cares about the troops. He went out there and saw it happening again. And he jumped on them in D.C. about having pre- and post-deployment physicals. And, you know, we got it in law, but, you know, they came out with a survey instead of hands-on. And, you know, so it doesn't matter who starts it, but we all should get together and unify, you know, to get the job done type thing. And, you know, I was one that saw Steve, you know, put his foot in the door about that, and he was touring around the bases on those early in OIF, OEF, of returning and how badly they were being treated. And he had problems, despite all of his years in the military. He had problems. He was kicked off some bases, but he was speaking out for the vets. And that is what's needed. And, you know, it's sad that a veteran has to do that. But that's what happens every time, and I want people to know it, because otherwise nothing would be done. None of this would, you know, have even a chance of seeing the light of day. In the 90s, we had the media with us. You know, we were fighting them tooth and nail. We had the hearings on the Hill. I mean, just tons of them. And then, you know, Osagui started their town hall meetings, which we found that they were going in beforehand every base they went to and pulling records and taking them out. I mean, we tried to notify the vets, get copies of all your records. And after Osagui team were there, we'd get phone calls of, guess what, I found stuff missing out of my medical record, out of their own medical record. Not only records of the units, but medical records.
Well, you know that happened to me, and you know our command staff, when we tried to find the records that were shipped back from 3rd Medical Command following Desert Storm, as you know, you've talked to everybody involved, the Connexes were found empty.
Right.
I mean, totally
there's
verified.
There are so many stories about medical records being found, you know, missing. I know I had them for my log-based trolley for the Masset. They were issued to me. I had to sign for them. I turned them in, so I know they were turned in at Kelly. Now, where they've gone since then, and another problem that happens after almost every war, we saw it with Vietnam, we saw it after the Gulf War. I don't know if we've seen it yet on OIF, OEF, because
it's
current, but what we see is units being disbanded, or the units being combined, realigned, and we're losing those records. I mean, my unit at Kelly was changed. I transferred up to a Chicago unit. Chicago Aeromedical was disbanded. You know, where are all those records being tracked at? Who knows?
Well, at one point, those records were supposed to have been transferred to the administrative section right there in Denver.
Well, and that's been transferred now.
But that base closed then, too.
Yeah. Fitzsimmons closed, and then Lowry closed. We've got Buckley still. But the Air Force Reserve Personnel Center, you know, is no longer, it was out at Lowry. It's no longer there, you know. So, you know, when they do these things, there should be a tracking method that we can tap into. I know that when Osagui was going on, I called them for the benefit of my unit, and my unit being Aeromedical Evacuation Group out of Texas, we were scattered all over. We had people in theater, throughout the theater. We had people in Europe. We had people back home that were activated. So they were scattered all over creation. And, you know, I documented my group where I was at Log Base Charlie and kept asking Osagui why we weren't on lists of exposed units and all that. And they hadn't even gone and done the work. I provided the names of the personnel that were with my staging facility right on Tapline Road and yelled and screamed as much as I could. I don't think they ever accomplished the mission like I expected them to.
I think one of the things most, for me, the most frustrating, as you know and totally verified, when I went on to active duty again in 1994 as the director of the U.S. Army Depleted Uranium Project, Dr. Marshall started finding all the medical problems on all of us at the Chemical Corps School that had came back, you know, working with this stuff, and you've talked to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And they literally separated out our medical files, confirming the physiological effects of our exposures and the physiological and psychological effects of our ongoing research, especially with the DU project, put them into a separate vault. That then, when Fort McClellan was closed, as you know, my unit commander, at the 330th, was finally able to get them shipped to them. But again, separated out and hidden from everybody, and to this day, they're still missing.
And one of the things that should be done is not only do we tell everybody, and we have fantastic people, Cheryl Burks in Dallas was going to every plane out of DFW and briefing soldiers as they left and as they came back, get records, get copies of your records. You know, those copies should be maintained. Everybody, when they exit the military, should get their own copy provided to them. I mean, how hard is that? Give us copies of our personnel record and our medical record.
You know, the unit clerk has got all that stuff right there in the unit admin section. The copy machines are right there, extraordinarily handy. So, again, it's something that should be done.
And now they could be scanned, and you could get a little thumb drive with all your records on it.
Correct.
That's never been done. I think we need to work up a law that requires that to be done, because I don't trust them anymore. Too much has happened that I no longer trust my own government that I went and served for so many reasons.
You've gone through a lot where you trusted them and continued to wanted to trust them.
And, you know, I came back and I wanted to stay active reservist. And being a flight nurse, you don't acknowledge problems. And the pilots do the same thing. Anybody on flying status that gets annual pistols aren't going to admit they're having problems if they want to make their 20 or their 30. And, you know, they won't acknowledge it. And then it comes back to bite you in the rear.
Well, I know that happened to us during the Vietnam era because, as you know, I was on flight stats and B-52s and KC-135s during the Vietnam War, flying out of Anderson, Utapau, and Kadena, and then Westover and Fairchild here in the States. But as you're absolutely correct, I mean, when you're on fly status, even the slightest cold, you take care of it yourself because the minute you go to the doctor, well, you're grounded.
You're grounded. Then you have to go through requalification. You know, you have requirements that aren't there for the ground troops. You have to be qualified in the air, doing your duty so many times a month, you know. And you have to be on the plane.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not in your crew position, at least being on the plane, being part of a training mission, to be, you know, marked down as being in the air even. So all that is different for the Air Force personnel. And you don't want to have to repeat all that training. And
no,
so,
just...
yeah, you have a reason not to tell the truth sometimes because you don't want to get grounded. You don't want to have to go through requalification and recertification and all that. And, you know, it really, you know, I did wrong, and I know others did wrong. We didn't acknowledge we were having problems, and we were watching it happen.
I think what's really important, and when we got the post-deployment physical form, DD-2796, and ladies and gentlemen, we'll get it on the PRN-FM website so that you can get it downloaded, or, you know, it's up there and other things, Beyond Treason, it's there, and some of the other ones is on the grassrootspeace.org website, or was. But it's extremely important when you look at this physical, as a Department of Defense form, that you continuously update this, because the physiological effects, we didn't see them all immediately. We had some that were immediate, but then we've seen some that develop long-term. We've seen some that are absolutely become aggravated with a period of time.
You come home from a war zone where you haven't been told the truth. You were told the alarms were false, not to worry.
And they were all active, true alarms.
Yeah, and, you know, you came home, and you may not feel exactly like you did, but you go, hey, you know, we were gone for 6 months, some longer, a year. And you just figured this is just part of readjusting, you know. You don't think about it. You know, you're military. You're trained not to be a gold bricker or a wimp, you know, and that's what they called a lot of the reservists and guards that came out early on because we could versus the active duty that got stuck on, you know, our temporary disabled list. And
they were put in holding companies.
They called us all gold breakers and wimps, that we weren't as in shape. Excuse me. A lot of the Reserve and National Guard were also the ones that decided, hey, active duty's not for me. I can be a reservist and have that part of my life to go on and then do other things in civilian life. And you just don't put it together.
I think what everybody doesn't understand, and I know from having been on the 3rd MedCom command staff at 12 p.m. where we were theater of medical command and then doing all the worst with WMD and hazmat, is that the active duty in the civilian world do not understand that overwhelming, probably 75% of the military's medical assets are in the Guard and the Reserve. They're primarily in the Reserve.
Correct.
And all of their medevac assets are in the Air Force Reserve. And, I mean, how many medevac units do you have?
98% for the aeromedical were in the Reserve.
How many?
98%. And, I mean, we had the ones assigned to C-9s at the time, which has been retired, I believe, and 141s. And that was a small portion. And as far as combat duty, we had, I think it was the 1st Air Vac down in one of the southwest states, that, you know, anything happened, they were immediately notified. And we had two group sizes, one over in MacDill, Florida area, and ours at Kelly. And depending on what part of the world of who went first, Panama, my unit was immediately involved, if MacDill was not. When Gulf War kicked off, the first units to go were the ones out of Florida, that group size, and whatever.
Well, the medical command came out of Florida National Guard, out of the 202nd.
Yeah, and then, you know, when they saw it was going full tilt, then, you know, they activated other units and how many people they needed from each unit. And then when we got over there, our aeromedical staging facility was supplemented with 3 flight crews, so that if we had to originate flight crews, we could also maintain the staging facility and still have people to put on board and take care of flights that we could originate and not have to have a flight crew come in. That very seldom happened in Gulf War. I think we had one that we got off on a flight out of our location. But those 3 flight crews came from 3 different units. You know, the squadrons and the flights got all divided up. They had no unit integrity at all. They were all scattered all over creation, worse than the group sizes were.
Well, I think when, you know, you and I didn't meet during Desert Storm till years afterwards. But
that we remember. I was at KKMC and you kept going, "Do you remember me?" We were doing briefings when y'all came through, and I still can't, you know, put that together as if we met there, but we got briefings when we hit Riyadh.
Right. So I remember, again, we're handling, your unit is coming in, we're getting ready to forward deploy your unit up to the tap line to set up there at Long Base Charlie. But if I remember correctly, you landed in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh, in the middle of a Scud attack.
Exactly.
Didn't you? I remember because the Scuds were coming in when your unit landed.
That was the first Scuds that went off, because the Aeromeds had a problem. Somebody at Pentagon was missing and the orders weren't signed as quick as they had figured. So they were scurrying to get us all over there. And, in fact, we ended up, Dover. As they launched the war, we watched that on TV as we're all gathered in a holding area and going, okay, we got to get there. And it was, you know, the runways are busy with fighter jets and everything else going off. And so we were bringing in our group was flowing in then, and flights and squadrons. Now, we had dedicated planes because we had a lot of the equipment.
Yeah, because I remember
squadrons didn't.
We had you staged to set up over there, which would be the northwest corner of the airfield at Riyadh, so then you could go forward. There was a building up there we were staging you guys at when we briefed you as you came in.
And so we got in, our plane got straight in. The one following us, I had to divert and go back to Europe and land before they came back in because the airfield got so busy they couldn't get them in. So there was a lot of that going on. And when we landed, we spent 7 days there at Riyadh. I think it was 7 days. Yeah, it seemed like we moved.
One long before you went forward.
Before we moved forward. And during that 7 days, we were busy. We'd pick up the slack and help go pick up the crews coming in. and getting them to process in and get a place to sleep. So we moved them forward. So, I mean, we had people that I had met in training exercises, Patriot Spirit, one of the largest training efforts ever before the war happened, that was out in California, Fort Irwin. And so we land, and the person picking us up with the bus driver was one of the people I'd met at that exercise. But we ended up, we barely got off the plane and got to the little Quanta Hut thing.
I want to repeat, with the alarms going off because of the confirmed chemical agents on the Scuds.
When we got on the bus, we were hearing that the Scuds had gone into Israel. It was live. It was real. And, you know, we grabbed our equipment, put our gas mask and mop gear on, and, you know, shortly thereafter, the all clear came in, and we're at the runway area, and I'm going, we've got to get off this runway area. It's a target area. I mean, anybody with any sense knows that. Well, then they wanted us to turn in our weapons at the armory, and I'm going, we're in the zone, and you want our weapons and ammunition. Well, medical people, you know, the officers carried the sidearm, and the enlisted had the M16s. And we're going, great, we have to have one group go over and turn that in, and we've got to get over to Escon Village or wherever they're sending us to bed down. So we were there for 7 days and helping pick up people at the airfield and, you know, get them situated and getting briefings ourselves at Riyadh. And then we moved forward to KKNC. And we were there for like 7 days, and we moved forward to Log Base Charlie in the middle of nowhere on the Tapline Road. And all that was there was a little hexagon small tent.
Yeah, well, I got to understand, the Tapline Road where your unit was at Log Base Charlie was on the Iraqi-Saudi border.
About 7 clicks off, I think.
7 clicks, you know, is like 3.5 miles.
But so we got up there, just a small hexagon tent there for communication and offloading supplies as it went forward. You know, the 130s would come in with supplies and offload them. They had the flatbed trucks being run by the third country people. You know, dumping their supplies there at the log base, and that was where the 130s would land, one of the many log bases we had. You have supplies coming in for the war effort on the forward capacity of the plane. When they left, we put, you know, our patient load on. So we'd go on and configure the airplane, hopefully have the patients there long enough to assess them from the Army hospitals for any needs they may have, and to check that they were able to go flying. You know, if their blood levels weren't good, we had to question that. Had to have Pleurivacs in, not chest tube bottles, and have the valve in place for, you know, transport by altitude. All those kind of checks were being done, being sure we had good IVs on them and their basic vitals before we would get the plane in and load it. Most of the time we had them on the ground long enough to do that. Occasionally we'd get the bus pulling up at the same time the plane pulled up, and we did bus to plane transfer.
Yeah. I think what I want to go into now, we're talking about a lot and all the problems.
Right.
The known exposures. First off, again, from the 3rd MedCom, Medical Command Bowers Radius was formed, and now you have talked to most of us, and as you know, too many have died now. But we had definitely confirmed with the chemical agents, because the United States had given Iraq the chemical and biological weapons, along with England, Germany, and Office of Soviet to put them in. They developed their own. The chemical warfare nerve agents said, we absolutely know that were there, we were exposed to, were sarin, cyclosarin, taboon, soman, VX, multiple 7, and the Novichok.
And Lewisite.
Correct. And now, because
and
of the other problem we ran into, because we knew that they had all of the nerve agents, and they would use them, and they did use them, and we had, again, I want to go back and I want to reiterate over and over again, the 3rd MedCom CENTCOM chemical logs confirmed all of this stuff was there. And as you know, they were ordered destroyed in 1998 by Lieutenant General, the MEDCOM commander, as you know.
Right.
We all know that that all happened. And then again, the general at GAO has confirmed that. Cy Hirsch confirmed that also when he wrote the book Against All Enemies. So what we had then, because of that, we had to take pyridoxine bromide, PB. And again, PB with a little white tablet, but PB or pyridoxine bromide itself is a nerve agent. It's a carbamate-based nerve agent. And when you look at the material safety data sheet for PB, it's frightening. PB can be used, and it has been used, previously for medical purposes, again, looking at neurological diseases. But the intent with the known nerve agents there is we wanted to try to save lives as many as possible. And that was, again, what the 3rd U.S. Army CENTCOM Medical Management Chemical and Biological Casualty courses that we taught. That was Bowers Rader's primary duty for the whole of CENTCOM and everybody else, and a lot went through it. It's a pyridoxine bromide. What we had to do is you had the 21-pill tablet in the foil pack, and you were going to take it. Now, PB is, as you know, and you were involved in the congressional hearings, is a nerve agent itself.
Right.
And so when you have very low level of exposures, the idea for PB, and the reason we had PB put together, was to lock up the synaptic junctions that when you administered the primary drugs of choice, that you could reverse the effects of the neurological thing. That's the Mark I antidote kit that everybody took. Okay? However, when nobody took the antidote kit or did not have to have any of the atropine or diazepam or proxibutrin chloride drugs, the PB started to catch up on the individual. And I distinctly remember, because I was back down in Alabama talking to you on the phone when you were in the congressional hearings, where we read right out in the Army Medical Manual directly confirming over 50% of everybody got immediately very ill from the PB, and yet they were still total denial. So we know that happened. And when you go to the material safety data sheet for pyridoxine, the PB stuff, it's scary as can be. Again, very limited use. Again, it was not designed to be used as it was used, and so we run into the problems there. Now, along with all of the nerve agents, the other thing, too, that we had
the list of biologicals from Senator Riegel's report.
Now, let me finish the nerve agents first, though. But the other thing, too, what we had is permethrin, okay?
Right.
And again, permethrin, again, is a very dangerous drug. And it also, when we look at the material safety data sheet, it is a pesticide itself, very dangerous pesticide. And what we were having happening, the permethrin was used, and I've got the can literally right in front of me with the national stock number, 6840-01-278-1336. And this was sprayed all over the uniforms. Now, what it says in the material safety data sheet and even on the can is this not supposed to come in contact with the skin. Well, it sprayed on the uniforms, and the individuals then put it on. Now, the other thing that they did not think about and plan about, but we warned them about, is permethrin. Even though it would dry on the uniforms, once you got hot and sweaty and with the oils and everything else and all the other stuff just in the body and the exposures, it then leached the permethrin right out of the uniforms into the body.
And here you're sweating. The pores are wide open.
Correct.
On your skin, so that you can sweat. And there's the open source for the promethrin.
Yeah, and so we have seen that. Again, it's confirmed when you look at material safety data sheet. It's right on the can. Do not allow it to come in contact with the skin. If it comes in contact with the skin, quote, wash affected areas of skin with soap and water immediately in the eyes, flush eyes with plenty of water, contact a physician if the irritation can persist. I mean, it's just staggering when we look at the incredible, incredible problems.
And they still, in the industry, think permethrin's safe because it comes from a natural source.
And it's not safe whatsoever.
And the industry, and if you ever have bed bugs, they're using promethium base to fight bed bugs. They use a permethean here in Colorado to spray the pine trees to try to dwarf the pine beetles that are destroying pine trees out here in Colorado. And yet you can get the vapors and the excess on you. And so that's another area of civilian use that needs to be looked at for civilian sufferers of chronic fatigue is, you know, to detail their exposure. So we had that, and the pesticides being applied to decrease the insects.
The pesticides, I mean, we ran up into a massive problem, and as you know, because you and I did it, you and I wrote the report, along with the rest of Bowers Raiders, the report on the misuse of pesticides in the U.S. Army during Desert Storm for the Institute of Medicine. And when we look at the list of pesticides, what had happened is because we were shipping bullets, beans, and bombs, and blood, the pesticides that had been approved for use by the EPA here in the United States that we knew had controls of never got to Saudi in the quantities needed. And so the decision was made to go out in the open market and get the pesticides. Well, the other things that we had incredible, incredible problems with is that we had very, very few people, and those of us, again, at Third MedCom and the Preventive Medicine, we were trained in pesticides and had civilian pesticide licenses at that time. But the majority of the people didn't have it. So when we look at the incredible list of pesticides that got over there, it's staggering. And I'm looking at the list right now, and there's probably on the order of 20 to 30, 35 pesticides that we identified knew that were there. And these are absolutely bad news pesticides. And they were misused. And we had all of those pesticide, incredible pesticide exposures, again, which are totally disregarded. So now we have confirmed nerve agents from the stuff that Iraq released on its own. We had the confirmed nerve agents that were released when we deliberately blew up all of the locations. And as you know, there were over 105 sites that we made the decision to blow up. And we made that decision in December of 1991.
And the only site that got any attention was Kamiseya.
Yeah, correct. And as you remember, do you remember when we sat with General Chuck Horner 10
yes,
years
I do.
After
it's
the fact?
10-year anniversary, the Kuwaiti ambassador in D.C. put on a function to recognize the 10 years.
Yeah, and we sat there, and Chuck Horner looked at you and I, and he said, you know, Doug, you guys were right. You know, when we blew all this stuff, all we did was release it. We didn't destroy it, and now everybody's sick.
And the VA is broken, and we didn't know how broke it was.
Yeah. So we had all of the incredible level of pesticides, and we had all of the incredible level of biological agents. Jimmy Toot, God bless Jimmy Toot, again, wrote the Regal Commission report confirming all the nerve agents and the biological agents. The thing most disturbing to us, and again, we knew this at 3rd MedCom with Bowers Raiders, is that the U.S. Army out of Fort Detrick, Maryland, had sent weaponized anthrax to Iraq. We got the shipping dates, the shipping numbers, the quantities, and everything. And so we knew we absolutely had to, no choice, to administer the anthrax vaccine, even though we knew the vaccine was for cutaneous anthrax, not respiratory anthrax. And we were ordered, as you know, and you've seen it, the GAO has confirmed it, CIHRS confirmed it, and everybody else, and we've told them for years, we were ordered, and everybody knew it, not to report who got what, when they got it, how much they got, and what the adverse effects were. I mean, a direct order not to do it. And when we look at the incredible list of biological agents, again, staggering. So we look at all of these physiological effects.
And one of the key things on the biologicals is where it was shipped to. And it was shipped to the Iraqi radiation people that can alter things. The biologicals could have been altered by the people that it was sent to.
Yeah, so it was just incredible. And so we've had all of this stuff, known problems, again, and you've talked to us, and then now, you know, Andres is dead, and Tom, we think, is dead. We can't find him. Jim Runge is dead. You know, all of this stuff, all of Bowers Raiders have paid the price, and we're all sick. But the incredible, incredible problems from the biological, with all the food contamination, the water contamination, the contamination that got into the starlighters, the showers we took and everything else, and just all over the place were staggering. And then we had the oil well fires. And when, and I think we were at the Center for Disease Control, and God bless Andres Carnegie Bot. I remember, I distinctly remember he's in his full colonel uniform, medical doctor in charge of all that stuff. He stood up yelling and screaming during the Center for Disease Control conference in, was it February, March of 1999, on the incredible, incredible known problems from the oil wells and what, you know, now we know all of the dust and the contaminant in the dust, which is defined as LS can disease.
Right, or you could name it silicosis. Because
correct, when we look at the list.
High in silica content.
When we look at the list from the oil, ozone, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, acetophene, benzoanthazine, biphenyl, chrysine, fluoroethylene, phenylethylene, pyrene, particulates, cadmium, chromium, nickel, lead, vanadium, zinc, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, M-xylene, and oxylene. I mean, staggering, staggering things. And that was the reason why when Tom and Jim and Andres came back, I mean, right as the oil well fire, and we issued the order at 3rd MedCom that nobody goes anywhere near the oil well fires without full respiratory and skin protection because of the known physiological effects. And Colonel Kennison had put the order out. I mean, it just went the heck in a handbasket.
Well, and they went right through the oil fields, the Marines, the Army, went right through that stuff. And the other thing we haven't brought up yet is the strikes that were made on nuclear facilities over there.
Say that again?
Depleted uranium. The strikes, you know, we took out some nuclear facilities that they had.
Correct, we did. We destroyed nuclear facilities. The other
and
thing, too.
And that's never been talked about, of radiation exposure from our hits on those. Much less depleted uranium.
You know, when I did the captured equipment project for the 3rd U.S. Army, and again, we found all the incredible radiological components and all the destroyed radiological equipment which was left over the battlefield, that was just a devastating thing. That was part of what we tried to do on isolated and everything, working through General John A. Guest, but then the captured equipment project and the transmission of all this equipment all over the world, and as you know, even over to Afghanistan for the Taliban, you know, bobs with me to this day, and Lebanon and everything else throughout Africa and everything else, so and the Balkans. So again, people that ended up being what we so-called the enemy today were provided equipment by us after Desert Storm. But the radiological components were staggering. And then when we get to depleted uranium, as you know, I mean, so many, and Mikey and those guys don't like me or other ones speaking out, we stated from right day one that depleted uranium was the Agent Orange of the 90s and has turned into the new century.
Right, and we had Clay Overstreet, people that were atomic vets that were speaking about that early on, even as we came home, talking about depleted uranium, even before I ever met you, Doug, was Clay Overstreet and the atomic vets and the people that had been involved in all this work for years and years.
You know, and Dom and all those guys, I mean, they had wrote that uranium battlefields, which resulted in 1992, in addition to our reports from the DU team, forcing the U.S. Army to put together the Army Environmental Policy Institute study on DU, from which General Shinseki wrote the orders to do the training, the environmental, and the medical, which got me back on active duty as a director. I mean, when you look at the new reports, and I just literally beforehand went to the Department of Veteran Affairs website to pull up the report on depleted uranium. And still, as of right now, as of this evening, they are denying any health effects on anybody. And as you know, when John Gingrich wrote the new report, he said, well, they've been following 79 people. But as you know, because you were involved when we went up to the White House with all those guys, and you know, what that was, what, in April of 99 or something?
Yeah.
And they denied any correlation that I had over 400 people on my immediate team and the 123
well,
that survived.
And they ignored Dr. Dr. Durakovich.
Colonel Asa Durakovich, yes. He was up there. He was up at Log Base Charlie, wasn't he? All this was happening.
I remember meeting him there, but I met him after the war. And he was trying to, in fact, I found out because I was up in D.C. during a Veterans Day, and my Vietnam vet friend said, hey, you need to talk to this Dr. Durakovich. He was at the Delaware VA.
Yeah, he had started treating the members of that from the 144th Maintenance out of Delaware.
Okay. And because he knew they weren't measuring it right, he got to the point of, I'll order the equipment and start testing it here at Delaware. And that's when they canned him.
Yeah, they didn't want it because all of my guys were coming out sick. And I think what was astonishing that we found out later, he had found this and reported in trying to get medical care. They canned him and stopped everything medical care for our guys because, as you know, the first cancers for the DU team started within 9 months of exposure, and the first lung cancers and deaths for the 144th were within 2 years. And then, you know, we got to on John Sitton and everybody else. He was denied medical care at the Danville VA Medical Center.
And yet we still do not have them reporting cancers and what type of cancers and what organ is involved. They say they're covering the brain cancers. It wasn't written into law, but supposedly they're doing that quietly. But, you know, that's one form of cancer. And I had contact with a doctor that got involved out of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And he kept the records, and I, you know, took those records and analyzed them and turned in a report to the RAC, turned it into the Hill, of the number of cancers that were above the normal level that you were, you know, if you pull up a normal population based in the U.S. of cancer occurrence. And they were above that. And to this day, they are still not doing anything with our cancers.
Well, as you know, we had an individual, and he was involved with Jimmy Toot, our inside man of the Department of Veteran Affairs, who's since deceased,
right,
totally confirmed that they were hiding the cancer data. And he had met with Jimmy Toot, and again, this is all documented in the movie we did for Showtime.
That was Bill
Thanks
Eddie,
for a Grateful Nation.
He was a Vietnam vet that stood up and tried to do the right thing. He was discriminated against so badly, he was scared to talk to any of us, even over the phone, because he had 5 or 6 children that he was trying to get through college. And, you know, they threatened his job. They threatened a lot of things with him. And so he had to go quiet, and we understood, you know, he had to support his family and his kids. And then he had a sudden heart attack and died. And he was one of our whistleblowers early on, trying to get the truth out there and to help the veterans, which is what his job should have been and was with the VA, much less being a Vietnam veteran.
I think the thing that bothers me the most, with all the information we know and the experience we have, the teaching we've done, the medical problems that we have, everybody we've encountered, and all the work we've done, we're seeing exactly the same physiological and psychological effects on OIF, OEF from the same exposures. And again, the medical care is being delayed and denied. An experience I had most recently was
They'll write people on combat injuries if there's anything they can relate to a combat injury, knees, joints, things like that. If they can relate it to injury, active duty injury, they will compensate for that, and then they defer the presumptive things that we should be getting, the chronic fatigue, the fibromyalgia. All those claims get deferred, and it just costs more man hours for them to keep processing those. You know, vets are not going to give up. We've told them. The Vietnam vets told them, never give up. You keep going, because otherwise they win. And we were the ones that were there serving our country, doing our country's bidding. And, you know, we try our best not to let anybody give up. You know, don't give up. You keep fighting them. If you get a 0% or if they defer it, you keep fighting them. You give them new information, reconsideration of the claim. It's part of the reason for the backlog in the VA. They will not accept the presumptive diagnoses for Duff War only.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're at another ending. We'll continue this on. Denise, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, the stuff will be up on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, also in the Beyond Treason and on the GrassrootsPeace.org website. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and have a good evening. God bless America.